is her fate at this point? So where are we now in the story, Glenn?
Well, her fate was she was going to meet her. She was going to be the bride of death. She was going to meet her maker, so to speak, when Eros intervenes. And so this completely changes Psyche's fate. And Eros swoops in and takes her away to a palace, but it's not really a physical palace. This is a liminal space between the worlds. But it's there that he makes her bed for Psyche, and Eros instructs her that she cannot see him. She's forbidden to see him, but he comes in the dark of night and makes beautiful love to her. And eventually, Psyche, who's falling very much in love with him, but this is an erotic love forged in the dark, and she really wants something more. She wants to see her lover. She wants to have the full, total experience that she's been forbidden to do. Plus, her sisters kind of intervene, and her sisters tell her, in a kind of unusual way, that this could be a demon. You know, some kind of monster. So you better light the lamp and see who this is. And she eventually decides to take the advice of her sisters, and she lights the lamp. And Jean Houston would say that that lamp of remembrance is for men to remember the presence of women. And also, I would say, perhaps the presence of love and wholeness. So, but she lights the lamp, and she finds out that her sisters were completely wrong, that Eros is a god. He's beautiful beyond measure. And Eros does love her, but he's aggrieved that she did not follow the instruction, and he feels he has no choice but to leave. And that's when the myth really becomes most interesting to me and for the purpose of the book, Original Love, because it's then that Aphrodite comes back in the picture, and Aphrodite gives four tasks to Psyche to perform. I call them four labors of love, and they're all solved by an intervention from the natural world. This, to me, feels like very indigenous stories. So they're all solved by intervention from the natural world. So the first one, she's supposed to separate this gigantic pile of seeds by a certain hour. And there's no way that she can do that. But she gives up, she prays, and an ant nation comes. Hundreds and hundreds of ants come, and they separate the seeds within the appointed hour. And then she's given the task of gathering the fleece from rams that are by the river. And she's, again, she has no idea how she's going to be able to fulfill this task. And she's nearly ready to throw herself into the river and drown when a reed in the river comes out, and the reed speaks to her. And the reed represents the divine feminine, too. And the reed is telling her that what she should do is not confront the rams, but to go in the dark of night and go to where the rams have brushed against the trees and gather the fleece from there. So she succeeds again. And now Aphrodite's beginning to get a little impressed, you know, so she gives an even harder task. She's now supposed to gather the waters of life, which are on top of the highest mountain, and they're guarded by dragons. So how is she going to do that? She has no idea, but Zeus, she prays, and Zeus sends an eagle. And the eagle is the symbol of masculine power. And the eagle flies between the dragons and takes in his talons the vessel, fills it with the waters of life that run all the way to the underworld, and returns successfully. And then the fourth one is the hardest one of all. She's supposed to go to the underworld and meet with Persephone and gather her own beauty ointment. In this case, she doesn't even know where to begin. She doesn't know where the gates to the underworld are. And she climbs a tower, and she's about to throw herself off the tower and commit suicide again. And that's when the tower itself speaks to her and tells her exactly what she must do. And this one's pretty involved, so I'll just say that the tower tells her where to go, and she has to put 2 coins in her mouth and hold 2 breadcrumbs with her. She gives 1 coin to the ferryman on the way into the underworld, 1 coin on the way out. And then there's the 3-headed dog Cerberus, which is guarding the gates. This is the funniest one. She gives 1 morsel, or she holds up 1 morsel and allows the 3 heads to fight over it while she's entering the gates. And then she does the same thing on the way out. And she succeeds in everything except she was forbidden, if she received the beauty ointment, to open it. And that's the only thing that she lapses. But really, you know, the myth is sharing with us something that we all can relate to, because we all lapse. You know, we have a spiritual path that we're on. You have a beautiful spiritual path you're on, Justine, doing New Dimensions, you know, interviewing some wonderful people. And so you are on your spiritual path. But, you know, I can't speak for you, but we've all lapsed at some point in our lives. But we can recover. We can recover and rededicate ourselves to that path that we're on. And, you know, the beautiful thing about the myth, of course, is that when she did open the jar, the beauty jar, she becomes immediately unconscious, a kind of death, like Sleeping Beauty, or maybe Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz. And it's only then that Eros feels like she cannot die. This is who I love. And so Eros intervenes and awakens her, and then takes her to Mount Olympus, and she becomes a goddess. And of course, she's the goddess of the soul. I opened that chapter in the book because I went to a beautiful place I like to go to, which is 30 miles north of Taos, New Mexico, at the confluence of the Rio Grande and the Red River. And when I was there that day, nobody else was. It was a very cold day in January. And I said a prayer, laid down some tobacco, said a prayer. And then as I was gazing upon this beautiful, powerful confluence, for some strange reason, moths appeared, but they didn't look like moths to me. They looked like angels. They were blessing me. And there shouldn't be moths in January. Maybe it's climate change. I don't know. But there shouldn't be moths in January, but they were there. And that's what Psyche is, of course, in mythology. She's either the butterfly or the moth, because the word in Greek means that, and means the soul as well.
So it, in that way, in that beautiful, beautiful myth, how does it apply to us today? What information is it giving us for how we can better live our lives today?
The message that's coming through that is completely applicable to today is that we do need to welcome and invite and include all of the natural world in both our decision-making processes and into our psyche, so that our psyche doesn't exist. And, you know, the word psyche has come to mean something very different than it used to. It's come to mean like an individual psyche inside, you know, your head or my head, but it's not like that. You know, psyche, you know, like the beautiful poem, Psyche lies down in the grass. Psyche is in the field that's between us, you know. So psyche is present everywhere, just like love is.
And I'm thinking, Glenn, too, in the 4 labors of love that she is given from Aphrodite, and it's going back to the idea of strife, that we get these, whatever you would call them, these labors, these instructions, okay, go do this, and it may seem, oh, insurmountable. What she does is she calls on the natural world, or the natural world shows up for her. And when you're talking about that beautiful gorge of in north of Taos, which I've been to, I've sat in that same place, and of that magnificent terrain there and the deep gorge and what's happening there. And in that way, we're reconnected with another source that's available to us all the time.
Yes. Yes, beautiful. I couldn't agree more.
So let me ask you, more than two generations ago, we all experienced seeing our precious planet Earth from space, from the Apollo 8 mission. And so we have this new mandala of this precious planet hanging in the darkness of space. And I thought that that would really change our consciousness, and maybe it has, but now it's been two generations since then. Are we on a good trajectory? Are we going to make a change in consciousness to accommodate our well-being on this planet?
Well, I call me an optimist, but I believe that we already are making that change. I mean, what you're speaking about is sometimes called the overview effect, and that was a powerful reminder to the people on the planet of how we're embedded in the cosmos. And how we're all one. I mean, there's no, you know, when you're looking at the Earth from space, obviously you don't see the political divisions that mark the lands that we're calling nations. No, none of that exists when you're looking at it. It's one whole. It is happening. But, you know, later on in the book, I do look at something was looked at in Stockholm. They were talking about how there are, I think it's nine boundaries where if we were to cross even one of them, we would be doomed as a species. And then it's determined that we've already crossed four of them. I think since I wrote that, it might be six of them, you know. But I do say even then that I don't really believe that we're doom, because consciousness, the shift in consciousness, and that's everything that New Dimensions work has been about, you know, for so long. The shift in consciousness is incredibly powerful. And when it does happen, anything is possible. And it has to happen. And to some extent, it's going to be prodded into happening by the disastrous consequences that we are already experiencing by the actions we've taken on our soil, on our water, on our land. I like to focus more on the soil and the water. In my lifetime, I have seen the degradation of water so strongly. When I was a teenager, I visited Spain, you know, on my father's side of the family, it's Aragon Spanish and Basque. Friends from the High Pyrenees in Spain. And when we were traveling in the High Pyrenees, we stopped for agua fresca. We stopped whenever there was this beautiful, clear spring. You know, I wonder if people are still doing that because water has been so despoiled. But that's the prayer that I hold, is that we remember that we are the light, air, water, earth, and that we begin to take that deeply into our bones so that our behavior changes and we no longer drill through oil, through water for oil, because we realize how crazy that is. We no longer, you know, mine rapaciously this earth because we realize that these things are precious. You know, like the Acama and Laguna people would say that the yellow cake or uranium, it should be in the earth. It's sacred. It's sacred. And it was Paula Gunn-Allen who once told me that the word sacred is only one letter removed from the word scared. And she said that's because what is sacred has power.
There are many of us who are living in grief. We are grieving this loss. And you talk about grief as a path to wholeness. So I think that it would be helpful for us to hear what you mean by that, because many of us are just at a loss and just feeling overwhelmed with despair.
Well, I'm glad you used the words at a loss. So what I did write about is love and loss. So I think it's love is what evokes wholeness. Loss is what rips it away. So, you know, Eros, if we return to Eros for a second, you know, when you receive a lover's touch, you're awakened, your soul is awakened, you may feel the fullness of life. But when somebody dies that's very, very special to you and very, very precious, then that's ripped away. I don't care who you are, that's going to hurt so bad. Doesn't matter what your spiritual development is, or because you're still not going to be able to hug that person. You're still not going to be able to kiss that person. But that person may take up residence in your own heart and continue to inspire you. And then they become what I like to call a living ancestor. So there's something that can come about through loss. And it's a little bit like related to strife, like we were talking about. Loss is a tremendous form of strife because it becomes so difficult to even function, you know, when you lose a beloved. If you lose your mother, father, or a son, even harder is generally a daughter or son, you know, because that seems to be outside the natural order. And perhaps the hardest of all is to lose a daughter or son to suicide. So I talked about those things, because then you have the loss, and then you have the questioning of yourself, what could I have done? Mirabai Starr was an inspiration for me. She's somebody who wrote her first book, which was the translation of The Dark Night of the Soul. By St. John, you know, she released her first book on the very day that her teenage daughter dies in an auto accident. And Mirabai says that she traces the beginning of her spiritual path to the beginning of when she suffered that great loss. And so, you know, the grief can become a longing for the divine. It may not happen for everyone, but it can become this longing for the divine, because the divine is this oneness, the divine is this fullness and wholeness that love brings. And so that's how it's all interconnected. Going back to our previous conversation, there are people that are in grief now for the degradation to the planetary, the soil, the water, the earth. That makes a lot of sense to me. And some people take it really viscerally into their body. That's unavoidable when you're so sensitive. But at the same time, I would always say that for myself, I want to water the seeds I want to see grow in the world, and I want to give them light and air and fertile soil to grow. And that's all that we can do. And then I do want to operate out of optimism, not out of fear, because that's how things will happen in a positive way. And we are capable of immense positivity.
It's true. I agree, absolutely. And I know that in grief and loss, if even in the midst of great loss and grief, I remember when Michael died and I was feeling just this tremendous grief. And then I had this little inkling of appreciation for the depth of my grief, because I knew it was connected with my love.
Yes. Oh, what a beautiful thing that you've just shared with us. Yeah.
Yeah.
And before we started recording, I did say a prayer, and I wanted to invoke Michael because I know how important he is to you and to all your listeners.
Right,
And
right.
so thank you for bringing that to us.
Thank you, thank you. And I know you have some suggestions as to connecting with the power of the natural world. That's not just in mythology, that's also available, an energy, a vibration, that binding love, that original love in which we are totally embedded. Like gravity, if maybe it makes it more sense to say it's like gravity, so be assured it is there as powerfully and even more so than gravity. And if that's true, how can we then tap into it? I know that you have a couple of rituals, like forest bathing is one. Another, a beautiful ritual that you talk about, a moon ritual. So, if you could share those with us.
Oh, wow. Well, you're talking about Shinrin-yoku, forest bathing in Japanese. Of course, my wife is Japanese, so that is a very important to in Japan. It's really about being in the natural world. In a sense, we're always in the natural world. I'm so-called inside now, but my feet are on tile, and this tile is the stones of this area, and I'm surrounded by wood beams, and this wood is like the trees. So it's the natural world is always with us. But for most people, it helps to go out into what we call, a forest or something. In New Mexico, where I live, we don't have tall forests, except we do have some. If you go up into the mountains, we have some alpine forests. But here, where I am on the foothills of the Sandia Mountains, I've got pinyons and junipers. They're not tall. But we also have some cottonwoods down by the creek that runs through here. So we get to enjoy the four seasons. It's very beautiful. It's very beautiful. And I'm looking at them right now out my window. I'm looking at my window. So yes, please, please, go in nature, go at different times. I think it's very helpful to go in the dark of night and to go to a place where you can see all the stars and see the Milky Way. And then you begin to see how the Milky Way is a circle that's enfolding and loving you. And you feel integral and part of your galaxy. That is a very, very beautiful thing to do. But I mentioned the window before, and you asked about there's the poem of Rumi, which I do share in the book. And he speaks about allowing the moon to come and press its face against mine. Breathe into me. Close the language door and open the love window. The moon won't use the door, only the window. I always get goosebumps when I hear that, and it's partly because it also was very reminiscent of what Natsume Soseki, Meiji era professor, novelist, and he was an English teacher. And this I learned from my wife, Tomoko. She shared with me what Natsume Soseki assigned to his students. He assigned them the translation of the English, "I love you." And his students said, "Kimi o aisu," which kimi means you and ai means love. So that's a literal translation. But Soseki says, "No, that is not the correct translation. The right translation is Honyo no suki wa kirei desu ne," and that means in English, "The moon is beautiful tonight, isn't it?" Now, I want to share with you something, too, that I did not put in the book, but Grandfather Leon Secatero also used to tell us, he told me, he told many, that you can share your thoughts through the moon. Because the moon is the reflector of light, and consciousness is light. So if you share your thoughts through the moon, people can receive them. That's the ultimate smoke signal.
Oh, I love it. I love it. Thank you. Thank you so much for being with us today, Glenn. It's just been marvelous. I've been speaking with Dr. Glenn Aparcio Perry, author of Original Love, The Timeless Source of Wholeness. And to learn more about his work, you can go to his website, originalthinking.us, or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org, where you'll find more than 2,000 programs in our archive. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. I want to thank you for joining us today, and I invite you, please do join us again. This is program number 3,853.
New Dimensions Radio has been making a difference on our planet since 1973, thanks to the generosity of our listeners. You too can help make a difference with a tax-deductible donation or membership. Please visit our website, newdimensions.org, and just click the donate button. You can also subscribe to our free weekly podcasts and find over 1,000 hours of audio dialogues in our searchable archive. New Dimensions is produced by New Dimensions Radio in Santa Rosa, California, USA. Our executive producer is Justine Willis-Toms. Our post-production editor is Lou Judson. For over 4 decades, New Dimensions has been producing weekly conversations at the leading edge. We sincerely thank all of you who have supported us by being members of Friends of New Dimensions, as well as members of our affiliate stations. My name is Dan Drayson. On behalf of everyone at New Dimensions, whose endeavors make this program possible, I'm wishing you well. New Dimensions Radio is an independent producer supported by listener contributions. To find out more about the program you've just heard, to subscribe to our free weekly newsletter and our New Dimensions and New Dimensions Cafe podcasts, and to access thousands of other programs in the New Dimensions archive, please visit our website, newdimensions.org. That's newdimensions.org. Or call us at 707-468-5215. That's 707-468-5215. Please join us next time as we explore New Dimensions.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, your alternative to mainstream media. Broadcasting from Simon Fraser University at Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia.
This is Bird Note. Birds spend lots of time keeping their feathers in top condition. This can include bathing or perhaps sunning. But the number one means of feather care is preening. When preening, a bird first grips a feather in its beak near the feather's base. Then it slides its beak along the length of the feather toward the tip. This action smooths together the tiny structures called barbules that make up the feather, while also removing dirt and small parasites. If a bird's feathers get too dried out, they become brittle. To prevent that from happening, most birds have a gland located above the base of the tail that produces oil. Birds use their beaks to massage oil from the gland into their feathers to keep them supple. But how does a bird preen feathers in hard-to-reach places, like the head and neck? Using its beak, a bird can dab oil on its toes, then comb its head feathers with its toes. Or a bird might wipe its head directly on the preen gland, or uropygial gland, as it's called. Some bird pairs preen each other's head and neck, although this may be less about hygiene and more about keeping the bond between them strong and certain. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.